The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Good morning, everyone. So what I'm inspired to talk about today is mindfulness. I hope we don't talk about it too much around here. The same old thing, always the same. So hopefully it's different enough that it's meaningful for you. And in particular, I want to talk about mindfulness in the way that I believe the Buddha talked about it, which might be a little different than how we talk about it in the modern world. And there's nothing wrong about the modern Western Buddhist approach to using the term mindfulness, but it's useful to know that words, meaning of words, change over time, they evolve. We don't have to judge one era's use of a word versus another, but it's interesting to kind of see the difference. And I believe going back to the Buddha's time, we can it might highlight some aspects of this practice that are useful. As a footnote, this idea of words and how they evolve over time, the word generosity has a particular meaning here in the modern English, which means something like freely, generously giving, offering out of a kind of open goodwill to others. But the original word, when it first started being used in English, meant having a noble heart, being a sort of a nobility. And it's related to the word gentry, genus, and a kind of Latin word for a person or a noble person. And so apparently when it started off first meaning kind of a noble qualities of a person. A person was generous, had noble qualities. And then the 1800s or so, they started breaking down some of these big class distinctions and started using the word to refer to people who weren't technically nobles, that they had this kind of good qualities as well, noble qualities. And then it slowly moved from that general qualities of nobility to a particular quality of nobility, that of being generous. And so we've kind of forgotten the noble roots of generosity. But it's kind of nice because it represents perhaps that there's a kind of capacity for something in English could be called the nobility of heart, nobility of spirit, that we all can have. You don't have to be born a noble. And generosity is one expression of that nobility. So mindfulness, too, has evolved over time. So mindfulness in the modern world, sometimes teachers like myself are not so particular about how we use the term. And we might use the term synonymous with things like to understand, to know, to be aware, to be present. And it can kind of slide back and forth a range of things that are referred to when we use the word mindfulness. And there's nothing particularly wrong with that, but sometimes it leads to some confusion because someone might use the word mindfulness in one way and someone else understands it a different way, and so they think they're talking about the same thing, but they're talking about two different things. Mindfulness is an aspect of our capacity to know or to be aware, and I think it's very meaningful to consider that everything that we are aware of in the world, we are aware through the vehicle of awareness. We know through our capacity to know. And that seems like a silly thing to say, but many times we focus so much on what we know, what we're aware of, we're not aware that we are aware. And one of the things that practice can do is it can heighten not just what our capacity to see clearly what's going on in the moment, but we get a heightened sense that we are aware, that there's a kind of a, and everything gets mediated through our capacity to be aware. Even our inner life, we have to be aware of our inner life, and that awareness of our inner life happens through the filter of awareness. We might innocently think that awareness is just like an open window or a clear mirror, and that everything that comes through there is just the way it is. But in fact, awareness is a relatively complicated neurological event. Just for example, you know, I think many of you know that just the ability to see, we can go around a lifetime seeing things and thinking that we see things just as a very simple, straightforward thing to see. But the act of seeing is a complicated act. Photons strike the back of our eye. It stimulates nerves in our optic nerve. It goes up into our optic area of our brain and gets reorganized there. And then somehow we take all these signals that come in there, and the brain has ability to organize it and construct it in such a way that it has a useful correlation to how our world is like, so we can get around. And we think that this is an easy thing to do until it starts getting difficult. Maybe it's fortunate, but it doesn't seem that babies, when they're born, see things very clearly. They see a jumble of sensations, of sights, and slowly, slowly, they begin to organize it in their brain until they have something that looks like what we see. So there are a few times in our life, perhaps, where the sense of being aware will stand out and highlight. And so we're not just simply aware of something, but we're aware that we're aware, because the awareness is very powerful or strong or connected or very still. And often it kind of comes together for some people with a sense of being present, kind of a presence, not a presence of some entity, but a sense of being present, offering presence here for what's going on. So I think sometimes in acute danger, or maybe right after acute danger, just after a near accident in the car or something, there can be suddenly all the things we're preoccupied with fall away, and the fact that we're still alive and acutely aware stands out in highlight. Or being with someone as they're dying or soon after they're dead, sometimes people find that the usual concern about their taxes and what's on television and what are they going to have for dinner and their shopping list and how they're going to get the oil changed in their car all at once kind of falls away at the deathbed of someone. And a lot of concerns fall away. And in that falling away, in that poignancy of that time, some people will have a very strong sense of presence there. And that sense of presence sometimes can be interpreted a variety of ways. Sometimes the presence of the person is still there. Sometimes it's a presence that kind of emanates from us. But a sense of very strong awareness that is different than what we're aware of. Sometimes in sexual intimacy afterwards, there can be a strong sense of presence that's there, kind of stillness, awareness that seems to be broad and peaceful. We're not really involved in our thoughts so much as we usually are, but just being, a sense of beingness. So this sense of clear awareness, clear presence that is not caught up in the thoughts and concerns of our life, some people refer to it as just an experience of being. But that awareness is always there. Otherwise, maybe not when we're sleeping, but it's always there in our conscious moments. There's awareness. And it's missed because we're so concerned about things. We're involved with what we're doing. We're focused on what we're doing. We're involved with our thoughts and our worries and our concerns. We're involved in we're involved in something, or images or visualizations. And you can see that in meditation, or be aware of it in meditation. And you can feel sometimes in meditation the difference between a mind which is wandering off in thought, so much so that you weren't even aware that you were involved in thought until you kind of wake up and realize you've been thinking for the last 5 minutes about something. And then you can let go, and once you let go, there's a kind of different kind of presence that's there. Maybe it's not very strong, different kind of awareness or something that's there, a difference than being involved in our thoughts. As we quiet down in meditation and as we let go of our compulsion to think, slowly there can be a sense of calm or peace that gets developed, but with that comes a stronger sense of presence, of a broader awareness that feels good. So in the time of the Buddha, if you go back to the discourses of the Buddha to see how he talks about the word sati, S-A-T-I, usually translated into English as mindfulness, there's a particular discourse that the Buddha gave called the discourse on the four, usually translated into English as the four foundations of mindfulness. It's probably, the word foundation is probably not a good translation, but I'll get to that. But this, the discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness is kind of like the root text, the foundational text of instructions for the whole mindfulness movement that we have here in the West, the Insight Meditation Movement. That's like our core text. And it's popularly it's considered to be, it's all about mindfulness, how you be mindful. A very curious thing happens if you look carefully at the text. The text says that if you want to be free of suffering, distress, lamentation, sorrow, grief, and despair, if you want to be free of suffering, you need to establish mindfulness. That's the vehicle. And then it's going to say, how do you establish mindfulness? And it says, you establish mindfulness by contemplating the body in the body, being ardent, mindful, and clearly aware. You need to establish mindfulness of feelings in the feelings, being ardent, mindful, and clearly aware. You need to establish, you need to contemplate mind states in the mind states ardently, with mindful, and clearly aware. And establish, contemplate what's called, for now I'll call it the truth, true aspects of what, how our mind works, in and of itself, the truth in the truth, ardent, clearly aware, and mindful. So what's interesting here, I'm going to point out, the instruction are to establish mindfulness, and then describes how to do that by using the verb to contemplate or to observe. It could be, the word observe could also be used, but you contemplate. And then it says, how do you do this? So how do you do contemplate these four things? And then the text goes into 21 different instructions for how to practice with different aspects of our life, with different ways of being aware of our body, different ways of being aware of our feelings, our mental states, and the so-called what's called the truth here, the dharmas. When you look at how the instructions in these 21 different areas, none of the verbs for what you're supposed to do have the word mindfulness in it. So nowhere in this text does the Buddha say, be mindful, in the sense of, if you're breathing, be mindful of your breathing. If you have feelings, be mindful. Apply mindfulness. Apply mindfulness. Just like my mother would say, Gil, be mindful. And she meant, like, pay attention to what you're doing, because you just tracked all this mud into the house. And I just cleaned the floor. Be mindful, beware that, and she wants me to kind of do something with attention. Nowhere in the instructions of mindfulness does the Buddha use the word mindful as a verb. This is what you do. You do mindfulness. You following me okay? Whereas in the modern tradition, we often, when we talk about mindfulness practice, we often use the word be mindful as a verb. You should be mindful of your breathing. You should be mindful of this. Be mindful of this. Did you apply your mindfulness here? Someone will come to me and say, I had a lot of doubt. I'm filled with doubt, and it's really hard to practice because of my doubt. And I'll say to them, have you turned around and applied your mindfulness to the doubt? And they say, no, never occurred to me. Doubt has its authority. That's like, doubt about the practice is not the practice. Doubt is the truth. But if you turn around 180 degrees and are mindful of the doubt, very interesting things begin to happen. Sometimes the authority of the doubt begins to break up, and we begin to feel some distance from the doubt rather than being caught in it, for example. So I might say, be mindful of the doubt, as a verb, what you're supposed to do. But the Buddha didn't say that. He didn't ever use mindfulness as a verb, as something to do. But he did talk about establishing mindfulness. So then if you go through the discourses, the ancient discourses, see what kind of verbs, what kind of actions are used together with the word mindfulness, they are words like possessed with, endowed with, abide in. So rather than doing mindfulness, mindfulness is something we have. It's something that is established. Something that is, and the word established is used, you possess or you abide in. What's the difference between being mindful in terms of a verb of actively being mindful versus possessing mindfulness? Any suggestions? The difference? Anybody like to offer what you think about the contrast?
Doing versus being.
What?
Doing versus being.
So doing versus being. So one, you know, to be mindful is more like a doing. To possess mindfulness is more like a being. Okay? Someone else? Great. Someone else? In the back there? Maybe you can pass the mic.
By making mindfulness a noun, they've essentially separated it away from you. It's become something you want to attain. I want to have mindfulness. Uh-huh. Being mindful is something anybody can do at any time. So essentially, by making it a mindfulness that is their thing, it's an object which you're striving to obtain, but it's not something you can put into your behavior before you could obtain it.
Great. Could you hear that, everyone? It was a little bit weak. So he said that that by making it a noun rather than a verb, it becomes something that you can attain as opposed to something you can do. If it's something you can do, it's easier sometimes to access. You can just do it. Whereas if it's a noun, it's something you have to attain, maybe you can get around to it eventually, or some, you can do things that can attain it. Interesting distinction. I appreciate that. Yes?
Another mic.
Is there a mic somewhere over there? Jeannie has it, or?
Okay.
Good.
I don't know what I'll sing. No, I won't burden you with that.
You'll get our attention.
To me, a being is something that, along the lines of what I think you were saying, that you may have all the time, whereas a doing is something that you bring focus to at particular moments.
So this is an interesting distinction then. So the first person said that it's, or the second there, said that it's a noun, so it's something you can attain as if you don't have it. You're suggesting it's something maybe you can have already. And so it's not so much a matter of doing as it is to maybe realize or discover that it's there.
Or maybe that once you've attained it, then you should have it all the time.
Once you attain it, you can have it all the time.
Whereas you shouldn't just keep it in the back of your head and use it at opportune moments.
Mm. Okay.
I would say that mindfulness, the mindfulness, there's one that where you enter it and allow it to be, and the and then the other definition would be to apply it, mm-hmm. or to apply your mind to it.
So to enter into, so there's almost like a state that you can enter into, as opposed to an activity that you apply yourself to. Mm-hmm. And so the the language of entering is used in Buddhism, enter and abide, for entering into states of concentration. And so states of concentration are more the result of a certain practice. You do a certain practice of concentrating, and then you enter into and abide in a samadhi, in a state of concentration. And the state is a result of practice. So the same way, it seems that the word mindfulness, the way Buddha used the word, is more a result than it is an activity. And it's interesting that one of the most common places that the word mindfulness is used in the discourses of the Buddha is in reference to states of concentration. In the third, what's called the third jhana, a person has mindfulness and confidence. One abides in mindfulness and confidence. In the fourth jhana, one has mindfulness purified by equanimity. And some people in the modern world differentiate as if mindfulness and concentration are two different things. They don't go together. But here, one of the most common places mindfulness appears in the suttas is in connection to concentration practice. And the first, the third jhana, which is a little bit lower level of concentration than the fourth, it comes together with confidence. And it's interesting, the word confidence, can you do confidence or do you have confidence? Do you develop confidence or do you just kind of, make yourself confident? I would suggest that you don't usually in English talk about, apply your confidence. You might resort to your confidence or call forth your confidence, but confidence is something you have or you don't have. You can cultivate confidence. When the Buddha said in the suttas, cultivate mindfulness, he wasn't saying do mindfulness, he was saying do those things that establish the state of mindfulness. Make some sense? You still with me? Yeah. Losing one person, so. So if you look at this discourse on the four foundations of mindfulness, the word foundation, that's how it's usually translated, it's ambiguous what that word is, how it's supposed to be translated into English. And there's a lot of scholarly articles or writing about what the right translation of that word is. But one of the possibilities for how the word is, that's more likely than the word foundation, it means establish. The four establishments of mindfulness, the four ways of establishing mindfulness. So again, establishing the state. So how do you do that? So the text then discusses how you do that, and it suggests a variety of different ways. And the ways that you do it can be called mindfulness practice. It's the practice that leads to the state of mindfulness. And so because we call it mindfulness practice, in shorthand, we say, I'm being mindful. I'm doing mindfulness. But it's really a collection of practices. So in the discourse, it says, be ardent, be mindful, ardent, mindful, and clearly aware. It doesn't say be mindful. It means applying mindfulness. It means being in the state of mindfulness as an adjective. It qualifies how you're supposed to be. And then it tells you one of the most common instructions that the text gives is to know what's happening as it's happening. And they use the word know or to understand. So while you're having a feeling, know or understand or recognize the feeling you're having as you have it. When you're having a mind state, know that you're having the mind state as you're having it. When you have body sensations, know you're having those sensations as you have it. And that act of knowing is... Sometimes people consider that to be mindfulness. But here in the text, they're differentiating knowing from mindfulness. Knowing is knowing, and mindfulness is a state of awareness or presence. So knowing is kind of like the heart of mindfulness practice. So if I tell you that I run, that's all I say, it doesn't say very much. I could be running from danger. I could be running after the bus. I could be running in circles because I'm confused. It doesn't say much, I'm running. But if I say that I have a running practice, probably it then evokes a little narrower idea of what it means, a running practice. Probably means that I run regularly. I probably run to condition myself and develop strength and stamina and endurance and things. There's a variety of things we associate with running as a training, as a practice. And you probably don't think I'm running from danger from doing running practice. It's usually, right? So the same thing, mindfulness is one thing, but mindfulness practice is something else. So mindfulness practice are those things that help us establish the state of awareness, this open mindfulness, So to know is really important. To know what's happening as it's happening. The reason why I want to emphasize this is if we differentiate, distinguish between the important practice of knowing and the state of mindfulness, then we might begin to notice the state as it becomes stronger in us. I know some people who practice mindfulness quite strongly, dedicatedly, but only practice knowing this, and their practice remains a little bit too cognitive, a little bit too much in the doing mode. And they don't learn to relax into a state of awareness, a state of presence, a state of being mindful that is not a doing, but rather a being. Make some sense? So one of the places that I learned a lot about a sense of presence or awareness or beingness was through my Zen practice. And that was not by doing a lot of knowing, but rather by doing a lot of emphasis on being present for my posture and what's going on. Keep coming back. No matter what was happening in my experience, just be present for it. Just be there with it. And that's simply just practice over and over and just being there. Slowly, my preoccupied mind, my thoughts, my commentary, my judgments, but my living and my thoughts began to dissipate and get thinner and thinner, be less and less. And then the natural functioning of presence, of awareness, started to stand out and highlight. And this is one of the great treasures of human life. The treasure of having a sense of aware presence that stands out strong enough that it's stronger than our tendency to be involved in our fears, in our future planning, our past regrets, our concerns about others, our desires and aversions, all the ways in which our mind can be caught up and preoccupied. It isn't that we have to get rid of those, but something else becomes stronger. So, if you go someplace like to the beach or to the mountains, you might go there completely caught up in some big concern that you have, and your mind's kind of contracted around this concern. But it might be that there, looking out across the horizon over the ocean, or looking in the vista in the mountains, that somehow the expanse of it and the openness of it inspires you, and you realize that your concerns are only your concerns. There's something much more going on here. And so you start getting some different perspective of your concerns, where you still have your concerns, but they seem not so central as they were before. Or if you go backpacking, you could be completely caught up in all kinds of important things here, and a lot of things are so consequential here at work or in this, our usual busy life, perhaps. But you go up into the mountains, and after a few days, so many things don't matter anymore. And you meet someone who else is backpacking and hiking around the mountains, and it doesn't matter what kind of job they have, or how old they are, or what kind of car they have, or all kinds of things, or how they belong to a different class in society than you. Things that might be relevant in your ordinary life at work. But up there, you see someone and you see them in a fresher, more open way as a person. And so as things fall away, there's a different kind of presence, different kind of awareness that tunes into the present, is sensitive to the present, it feels kind of intimacy and openness to what's happening here. That is part of the reason people go spend time in nature. Same thing with meditation can happen. It can be harder in meditation sometimes. Sometimes it's easier. But one of the reasons it can be harder in meditation is that nature is not helping us. We don't get this, automatically this great big vista of views that takes our breath away. And there's so much authority in our mind around how important it is to think these things. And it's a radical retraining of the mind, or re-education of the mind, for the mind to have confidence and trust that there's something better to do in meditation than to think. Now, that's tall order. But as we clearly realize something better to do than to think, then we start letting go of the grip of thinking. And at some point, what can stand out in highlight is that we're aware. And awareness, to be aware, feels a certain way. You can have a sense of what it's like to be aware. There's a kind of maybe clarity or openness or spaciousness or knowingness or presence through which or within which we know and are aware of the things that we know and are aware of. And it's not so much a matter of doing, but a more a matter of relaxing and resting or settling back into or allowing for or tuning into or entering into the capacity for being aware or being present or being mindful, if that's still the right word we want to use. Some scholars of early Buddhism have used the word presence as a translation of sati, that being present for, because being present, you know, being present for is a little bit more ambiguous, whether you're doing or whether you're allowing. And maybe it's a nice word because it kind of bridges the divide between doing and being. To be present, when you have to do something to be present, but when you're present, there's no more doing. You have to allow yourself to be present. And so mindfulness as a state, mindfulness as a result. So as you practice mindfulness practice, clearly knowing what's going on, being with your breath, and the first instructions in mindfulness practice in the Four Foundations is to tune into your breath and then relax. Tune into your breath and calm your body and mind. So as you relax and calm, one of the things that can be useful to do is to begin noticing if there's some quality or character of knowingness itself, of awareness itself that's there, of being conscious. What is it like to be conscious? And rather than always emphasizing knowing and focusing on something, what happens if you then allow for that knowingness, that awareness, to be brighter, stronger? And rather than doing, applying, being receptive, allowing your experience to come into that field of awareness, or that space of awareness, instead of always doing. So I'll end with a story about mindfulness, or a parable that the Buddha gave. now it's a little bit, you know, it has a violent ending, so be prepared. But not as yesterday I took my 14-year-old son to see Skyfall. Oh. So James Bond, latest James Bond movie, so this story is not going to be as violent. Once there was a hawk that swept down and its talons grabbed a little quail and started flying away in order to, you know, eat this quail. And so the quail said, "Hey, wait a minute, hawk. You know, you think you're so great and strong and capable to hunt, but you know, if I had been in my home domain, my home territory, you could never have caught me." And the hawk said, "Oh yeah? You think so?" He said, "Yeah," said the hawk. "Why don't you put me back down, and then we'll see." And so the hawk said, "Well, where's your home domain?" And he said, "Well, it's in the open field, the plowed farmer's field." "Oh, I put you in the middle of there. You think I can't get you?" "Nope." So the hawk went and put the quail back in the middle of the field that had just recently plowed. And then the hawk flew high up in the air, circling around, and the quail stood up in a big clod in the field. And then the hawk then started swooping straight down. You know, you ever seen a hawk fly straight down, right, with talons open and ready to just kind of just grab that quail? And the quail is ready. And just before the hawk was going to grab it, the quail jumped behind the clod, because it was a big clod. And the hawk couldn't stop in time and slammed with its breastplate right up against the clod and died. That's the violent part. And so then the Buddha said, in the same way, monks and nuns, he said, when you're living in your home territory, in your home domain, you'll be safe, and nothing can grab you, nothing can get you and kill you that way. And then the Buddha said, what is your home domain, your home territory? Being mindful of the body in the body, being mindful of the feelings in the feelings, being mindful of mind states in mind states, being mindful of the truth, the dharmas. Mindfulness is your home territory. So there's something about resting in mindfulness, having this open sense of awareness, letting awareness be open and spacious, transparent enough when you really know something, then you don't just know it in and of itself, but you know it in the context of this spacious mind, spacious heart. There's something about that that makes us safe from the talons of our own clinging. And the Buddha said, that's your home domain. That's where you can live. Live in that space of mindfulness. Live in that state of open, relaxed awareness. So as you do mindfulness practice, experiment, tune into, trust, have confidence in, find value in, not just being mindful as an activity, but being mindful as something you rest in and allow for. And if you rest and relax in this wider state of presence, you probably find yourself a lot safer. And when the hawk of your mind swoops down to grab you, it'll be pretty easy for you to step aside. So, we have about 5 minutes left, and if you would like to ask any questions or comments about this, if it was okay, please.
The serenity of the oneness is where the truth is.
Serenity of the oneness is where the truth is.
Anybody want to say anything?
It's interesting that the Buddha would not have said that. Not to contradict you, but partly because this open state of awareness, of freedom, doesn't lend itself very well to having concepts about it. And so to have concepts of oneness or concepts of duality, a little bit messes it up, not quite to the point. So the Buddha just preferred not to make those kinds of statements. Not because, I would suggest, not because they're inaccurate, but because making them gets in the way.
I had an interesting experience, application of mindfulness in relationship. So it's trainings that I was doing with the group. And at first there was a lot of doings. I came from a place where I was not mindful pretty much at all. But it was funny, the feedback I got was, as I developed it, it was a lot of intensity and actually kind of scaring the person I was with in these exercises, because they were so focused on doings of, you know, where are my eyes, am I hands fidgeting, all these things about it. And that feedback was really, really wonderful, because it got me that exactly what you were describing of, like, just to relax. There may be a little doing, a little cleanup needs to start at the beginning of, you know, put the phone away and that sort of thing, to be mindful in that moment, be present with that other person. But if I can just relax, and then it's not like a doing process then of noticing, like, oh, hey, I just drifted off, or I just had a thought. It's just there. Mm-hmm. And it's, I so enjoyed that feedback of working with another person in that way, because it just the being caught is mm-hmm. interesting in that.
Yeah. So it's a little bit, so I add to this that as we develop the quality or state of mindfulness, it can be developed by more and more focus on knowing, but that knowing of what's going on can be active or it can be receptive. And as we receive into the field of awareness and our experience and know it clearly, then the mindfulness, state of mindfulness gets sharper and stronger and more pristine and develops more and more. And in fact, eventually, the further development of mindfulness will, I think, can only happen if you keep being receptive rather than active. If the mind is really busy and really agitated, it might be that necessary as a corrective to that to apply yourself and have more sense of doing as you do the practice. But at some point, it becomes less and less doing and more what in modern world we call just being. So, I hope this was interesting enough for you, useful. Thank you.